I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. This conversation was from 2017's Portland Book Festival, presented by Bank of America. The 2018 lineup has just been announced, and the festival will take place on November 10th in downtown Portland. For more information about the author lineup, schedule, and tickets, visit literary-arts.org. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature a conversation between novelist Miley Malloy and Claire Massoud. The event took place as part of our book festival in November 2017 and was moderated by writer and editor John Freeman. In 2017, each of these celebrated writers published an important novel. For Malloy, it was Do Not Become Alarmed and Massoud, The Burning Girl. Though these novelists are very different, these two books in particular share some important similarities. Both tackle the question of innocence and responsibility in the context of family life and friendships. What do we owe each other? What does it mean to be innocent? And what are the consequences of innocence? Interestingly, this conversation's backdrop is the 2016 presidential election and the hashtag MeToo movement, which had just started going viral. Both novels were completed long before either event, and so are good examples of how often our finest writers seem to have a connection to the unconscious undercurrent of our society. Here's our moderator, John Freeman.
Oh, it's so nice to be back here. It's also great to be in this church, you know, especially for a panel about innocence. Because only the other person in this church might know if we're all innocent. And I think, in a way, whether we're believers or not, reading fiction is an attempt to get into that space between what the world is and what we feel it to be, between who we are and what we do. And the writers that I have on stage with me are two of the most mesmerizing explorers of that gap. I wish I could tell you more about that gap, but we're going to explore it when we have a conversation to some degree about innocence. In A Family Daughter, one character says to another, this is Miley Malloy's first novel, "What's an adulterer?" And the adult replies, "It's a married adult." I think a lot of our panel can come out of that conversation. Because for the last 20 years, both of these novelists have been writing about the way in which society presses down on us ways that we're supposed to act, the people that we're supposed to be, and they reflect in the dramas that they tell the way that we actually act and the consequences of those actions. Whether it's in Last Life, Claire Massoud's novel about three generations of a French-Algerian family, or Miley Malloy's incredible first novel, not A Family Daughter, which is her second, but her first novel, which takes us through 50 years of a California family and all the grief and love and mourning that happens in that period. Or if it's Claire Massoud's When the World Was Steady, a girl going halfway across the globe to spend time with her ailing mother, or Miley's second collection of stories, Both Ways is the Way I Want It. So many characters in their books are caught between the ways that they think they're supposed to act and the ways that they're acting. But in this conversation, we're going to talk about their latest books. Do Not Be Alarmed, your moderator is prepared.
Become.
Do Not Become Alarmed. You should be very alarmed. Which is one of the most alarming page turners that I've read in a long time, about two families taking a cruise ship down towards Latin America who decide unwisely to take the zip line off site day and get separated from their children. And it's an amazing exploration of the gap between American privilege and American consequences. as well as a look at what happens when children are in that strange age between being children and being teenagers, and the power that they wield, especially when they're girls. And Claire's new book, I need to stretch. there's a woman shaking her head, and I agree. It's called The Burning Girl, which is a tremendously powerful and very brief novel about two girls the age of 11, and what happens when their friendship pulls apart through forces that are largely out of their control. One of them, two parents, well-educated, middle class, the other one with just one parent and a missing father. And over the course of the novel, you see the way that that divide opens up. Since this conversation is about innocence, I want to start with you, Claire. What was your family's attitude about innocence growing up? Were you told to be wary of the world because you were innocent, or were you told to be wary of the person inside you who wasn't innocent?
How long do we have? Let me tell you a little bit. I mean, that's a really interesting question because I feel as though, you know, I came from a pretty straight-laced family in a lot of ways, traditional family. My father's family, he was the only Catholic who had lapsed. The rest of them were super Catholic, and he had lapsed because he married my Anglican mom. So I feel that there were ways in which we were probably protected, and then there were other ways in which I think they felt strongly that we should learn about the world. And so, you know, whenever I hear, I remember my sister-in-law telling me that she had kept certain books from our nephew, although he wanted to read them because the material in them was challenging. And that was never the case. We were allowed, I mean, we were allowed to read anything we wanted, whatever we wanted, when we wanted. My mom had Ragtime in the bathroom when I was like 9, and I would read Ragtime in the bathroom. And then there was a Lytton Strachey book called Esmeralda and Ermentrude, which is about these two girls writing letters to each other about all the what they get up to on the back stairs at their houses, which frankly inappropriate, but I was reading that when I was about 11 or 12. I think both in terms of, they also took us everywhere. They took us everywhere they went, and they went a lot of places. We all went a lot of places. We were like the only family on vacation in Guatemala in 1973. there was no one else in the hotel. you know, so I feel like in that sense, they it was both innocent and not.
Mm. What about you, Maya?
That's such a good question. I was born in the 70s in Montana, and I think it was sort of late. The hippie movement got there late. And when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, all my parents' friends were divorced, and they all had all this stuff going on. And the kids really ran around by themselves so much more than they ever would now. And so when I think about some of the things that went on, I think it was insanely dangerous, but I think we were sort of protected by not having any idea that anything was dangerous, that innocence was a kind of protection.
And yet, in your stories, hitchhikers abound, danger is everywhere, people are constantly caught between very possible things and then things that could lead them into divorce and, you know, all other kinds of wonderful second lives. And is part of writing fiction looking beyond the protected bubble, or are you saying something that once you leave the protected bubble of childhood, that the world itself assaults you with its fallen nature?
The world definitely assaults you with its fallen nature. I feel that every day and in the past week and constantly. And I think, I mean, bad things were happening. Bad things certainly happened, and childhood is dangerous, and I feel like you're kind of constantly avoiding disaster all the time as you get through your childhood, any childhood. But it's part of the reason I wanted to write this book. Can I talk about that?
Yeah.
Has anyone read A High Wind in Jamaica? Yes, oh, a few. It's this fantastic 1929 novel by Richard Hughes about a bunch of kids who get taken by pirates. accidentally, and the pirates really don't want the kids. And the kids kind of love being on the pirate ship. And they are sort of protected by not having any context or idea of why they are, of how much danger they are in. And I read it, and I think partly because of my 70s childhood, thought, I want to write a book like that about kids who don't know how much danger they're in because they're kids. And that was really the sort of start of it, because I think that's true in a way all the time in any situation you're a kid.
I just want to jump in and say I think that one of the things that's really tricky about adolescence is precisely, you know, it's like the moment when you've been on the tightrope and then suddenly you look down. And I think, you know, that suddenly when you look up and around you at 13 or 14, you become either suddenly or over time aware of how much danger you're in. I mean, your guys are in serious danger, but even just, you know, I think, you know, you realize that, oh, the police will arrest me if I do that, you know, right. Which it's not the same as your mom, you know, grounding you or something. Hmm.
And yet, in The Last Life, Claire, you have your character who's narrating is a young girl, says, innocent then, I was taught to be afraid. And in this book, your character, who's 16 or 17 when she's narrating, looking back at being 11, says, sometimes I felt that growing up and being a girl was about learning to be afraid. Not paranoid exactly, but always alert and aware, like checking out the exits in the movie theater or the fire escape in a hotel. And it seems like one of the ways that your character in this book figures out when she should be afraid is by looking at her friend, by mirroring her friend and looking at what she's doing. And because she's not afraid, she's not afraid.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I feel like they are also two kids with really different temperaments, right? And I think the culture does teach us all, I mean, all girls to be afraid, and then you can choose to disregard the lesson or not, you know, depending on your temperament. But one of the things that, you know, that for me the book is about lots of different things, and one of them is the way the stories. We all internalize the stories that the culture feeds us, you know, whether it's Hansel and Gretel or CNN, you know, we're taking in these stories all the time. And the stories that the culture feeds us about girls is that you hit puberty and you're in danger. And at the same time, it doesn't, you know, there's a longer conversation around that. You young woman are looking for your autonomy, be free, you know, and so on. Be free, do this, do that, and then at the same time, and yet be aware that if you are free and you do this and that, you know, you terrible things are likely to happen to you.
Miley, in your book, the children get separated from their parents, and one of the most poignant moments in that separation is the two mothers are cousins, and they've been raised also differently, like the characters in Claire's novel. And one has biracial children, and one has white children. And she's thinking about the fact that the woman who has biracial children is thinking, I've raised my children to be good and not to be brave. And so she's thinking, have I set them out into the world to be more in danger because they're going to be afraid? And I wonder if some of what you're writing about in this new novel is the way that innocence is not a blanket condition, but rather conditioned very heavily by where you're from, where you live, and what color your skin is, and what gender you are.
Yeah, I mean, that's hugely what the book is about, and it's sort of what I figured out that the book was about as I started writing this book because I read this pirate novel. And it's really about six families. There are two North American families, two Central American families, and two South American families, and it's hugely about how much safety we think we can assume based on accidents of birth, and how vastly different they are.
I wonder if you can read a little bit from the book from the moment when things turn.
Yeah. This is pretty early. It's not too much of a... I hate spoilers. I hate knowing anything. So I always like to read from pretty early on. But he's already told you a certain amount, so... So they've gone ashore, and a series of small things has gone wrong. No one big mistake has been made. No one big catastrophe has happened. In the way that things go, small things get compounded, and they've ended up going to a beach, not realizing that there's a tidal river that comes out to the beach, and the kids have been playing on the inner tubes, and the parents have gotten distracted in various completely understandable ways. The kids were engrossed in a complicated game with the three inner tubes, making a kind of raft that they could stand on. It required a great deal of concentration. Hector was the master of the game, and he kept everyone involved. He didn't leave Sebastian and June out or cut them any slack just because they were little. Penny admired that in him. All of the chapters belong to a certain character. It's all third person, but it sort of shifts. And so this chapter belongs to Penny, who's 11. So this is in her head. Hector was good at building a structure, too, like her father was. He gave direction, saying, "Hold there. Now, Penny, you sit there. Okay, now you can stand up there. Now, Penny, too." He kept the whole three-ring raft stable. She loved hearing him say her name. Every few minutes, someone would slip or step in the wrong place, and everyone would go crashing into the water, screaming with delight, the inner tubes flying. Hector would make sure everyone was safe and afloat, and then they would start rebuilding. They were so focused that they didn't notice when the tide changed. It must have paused when they were first in the water. Then it reversed and began to flow inland. No one noticed that the water from the sea was pushing them upstream, slowly at first, and then with surprising force. When they finally looked up, waterlogged, each with an arm slung over a tube and legs treading the silty water, they were in a different place. There was no beach. There were no mothers on towels. The river was starting to narrow. It was overhung with trees. Penny squinted against the sun. She was hanging on to an inner tube with Isabel and had one arm over the smaller tube June and Sebastian were on. Her fingertips were pruned. She felt her little brother's arm slide against hers. Hector and Marcus were on the third tube. Birds sang and insects buzzed in the trees, but there were no human sounds. "What do we do?" she asked. They all looked to Hector, their leader. He frowned. "Should we shout?" Marcus asked. Together they cried, "Mom, Mommy, Mommy," in one shrill, beseeching voice. Then they stopped as if with the swipe of a conductor's wand and waited in the silence. There was no response. The river swirled around them. "I have to pee," June said. "Just go in the water," her brother said. "I can't." "Why not?" "I just can't. What about those fish that swim up the pee?" "That's in the Amazon," Marcus said. "Why couldn't they be here?" June asked. "Because the Amazon doesn't connect to here," he said. Penny already had peed and hoped those fish really weren't in the water. On the left bank, there was a tiny sloping place. They all kicked to it and clambered out. It felt good to be on solid ground. As soon as they stood up, it seemed clear that they should wait here rather than traveling ever farther away from their mothers. It had been smart to get out.
There's a lot of elements in both of these books that are like that moment in a horror film where you start shouting, like, "Don't go down the river!" And in Claire's novel, the two main characters, Julia and Cassie, decide, just because it's fun, to go break into a dilapidated former mental institution, at which point you say, "Don't go in there!" And I wonder, Claire, when you were writing this, and also you, Miley, if you were trying to send signals to the reader of dread without having to necessarily fulfill them, but you wanted the reader to feel fear.
Yes. I mean, I think you know, part of the cultural stories that make us afraid. You know, two kids go into a wood, right? It's not usually a cheerful, like, there's. Right, and then children break into an abandoned building. Not usually a cheerful one. So, in fact, you know, nothing dire happens. Oh, now you won't read the book anyway.
At least at that point.
But in life, it often. I mean, I feel like in life, one of the reasons you go into the abandoned building is because you're sort of challenging the story.
Right, which seems important. And there's a moment before that scene when things have gone wrong and they're not on the path they thought they were going to be on, and they're having this weird adventure, and one of the mothers thinks, like, this is good to have this adventure. We're too protected at home. This is going to be good for everyone.
Yeah, and then when things go badly, one of them thinks to herself, the karmic bus had mowed her down. She was being punished for living in a false world, spongy and insulated from the reality around her. This is one of the mothers as she's worried about the kids being free. And, Claire's novel is about the stories we tell ourselves to some degree. And it feels like your book is as well, because as this incident prolongs, the stories that people unspool have a lot to do with cultural guilt.
Well, I think we're always looking for explanations for why things happen and trying to make a story around it and punishment or blame. You know, the parents are blaming themselves and blaming each other, and people are judging and blaming them. I don't know if any of you saw this morning, but there's a family with a 6 and a 3-year-old who were on a river trip in the Amazon, and did you see this? Were taken hostage by river pirates and locked in a room on the boat they were on, and they escaped in the middle of the night with the kids on a surfboard and swam into the away. But they were like, yes, where those fish are. I don't know if they peed. And they hid in the bushes eating insects and fruit for 72 hours. And you look at their, I don't know, and it's impossible not to feel like, what were you doing, you know? Which is what people think about the families in this thing of like there's some sense that you must be responsible in some way.
Claire, in your book, because it's told in the first person and from not very much longer beyond the incidents that it describes, you have the feeling that Julia is assembling the truth in front of us. And I wonder if that puts you in any position as an author, if you basically are giving us the exact same amount of understanding as Julia has, so we have to arrive at it at the same time. What does that do for the book itself? You've written The Emperor's Children is a great, incredibly absorbing, sprawling family novel that cuts across continents. This takes place mostly in a short period of two 11-year-olds. And what do you do with that?
It actually takes place over a few years. There are three sections, and the first one is the summer after between 6 and 7, and then the second section is which I think of as time passes, is kind of 7th to 9th grade, and then the third section is the spring of 9th grade. So there are these different times, but it's true. The focus is pretty narrow. I mean, I think one of the things that, you know, for me, I'm increasingly uneasy. If what I aim to do as a writer is to in some way capture or reflect the experience of life, you know, life as I understand it, or as I experience it, I'm increased. There's a wonderful thing. I've been rereading Michael Ondaatje, and there's a wonderful thing in The English Patient where a character muses that a novel is a mirror walking down a road. Which is very lovely. But if that's what I'm trying to do, is be a mirror walking down a road, then I think I spent much of my 20s and 30s and maybe even a little of my 40s thinking that I was moving towards some sort of enlightenment and clarity and rational understanding of the world, you know, that I was understanding the answers better and better. And then I am now in a state of total the total collapse of that belief, and all I know is that I do not know, and now I believe I will understand nothing, and I will meet my end in total ignorance. And so as a writer, I feel like I have to in some way address that. And so this is a book that asks the reader to make the sort of decisions or interpretations that you do in life, because there isn't somebody in life who comes up and whispers in your ear, the person you are dining with is a gruff but generous being, and although you may doubt whether his intentions are good, I assure you that they are. Right? Like, it doesn't happen. So.
But it
we don't like that voice.
I know.
One of my favorite books of yours is your last book, The Woman Upstairs, which begins with this incredible passage that goes briefly, I'm a good girl, I'm a nice girl, I'm a straight-A, straight-laced, good daughter, good career girl, and I never ran out on a girlfriend, and I put up with my parents' shit and my brother's shit, and I'm not a good girl anymore. I'm 40 fucking years old. And I read that, I was like, all right, I'm in, okay.
Me too.
And it was a book about anger, and then I opened the first page of this book, which is almost like meeting that character at a young age, because it's before all of the stories that that passage calls out have sunk their teeth into Julia to some degree. And I wonder if you can read maybe from the beginning of the book,
sure,
so we can hear her as she's beginning to feel them,
sure,
descend.
It's a different story depending on where you start, who's good, who's bad, what it all means. Each of us shapes our stories so they make sense of who we think we are. I can begin when Cassie and I were best friends, or I can begin when we weren't anymore, or I can begin at the dark end and tell it all backward. There's no beginning before, though. Cassie and I met at nursery school, and I can't remember a time when I didn't know her, when I didn't pick her sleek white head out of a crowd and know exactly where she was in a room and think of her some ways as mine. Cassie was tiny with bones like a bird. She was always the smallest girl in the class, and the span of her ankle was the span of my wrist. She had shiny white blonde hair, almost albino, she was so fair, her skin translucent and a little pink. But you'd be wrong to mistake her size and pallor for frailty. All you had to do was to look into her eyes, still blue eyes that turned gray in dark weather like the water in the quarry, and you could see that she was tough. Strong, I guess, is a better word, although, of course, in the end, she wasn't strong enough. But even when we were small, she had a quality about her, a what the hell and I'm not chicken or you sort of way. According to my mother and to Cassie's mother, Bev, Cassie and I became friends in the second week of nursery when we were 4 years old. That was always the story, though I can't tell now whether I remember it, or I've just been told so many times that I invented the memory. I was playing with a group of kids in the sandbox, and Cassie stood in the middle of the playground, hands at her sides like a zombie, staring at everything, not apparently nervous, but totally detached. I left my friends to come touch her elbow, and I said, so I was told, hey, come build a castle with me. And she broke into that rare, broad smile of hers, a famous smile made all the better when she was bigger by the Georgia Jagger gap between her front teeth. She came with me back to the sandbox. And that, my mother always said, was that.
You know, which novel this reminds me of, but in a much slimmer fashion, is Elena Ferrante's first of the Neapolitan Quartet. So if you've run out of Ferrante to read, here's Ferrante Part 2. The one thing I loved about those Ferrante novels was that not just that they were so smart about friendship, but they never really plied you with guilt over what was happening in front of you. It just sort of unfolded as if it does in life, where tiny little decisions change. And Ursula Le Guin reviewed The Burning Girl for The Guardian, Portland's own, and she loved it for the reason that it didn't ply you with guilt. And I wonder, what is that say about us that we're looking in novels about women of this age, girls of this age, to be plied with guilt? Because that was my reaction, and it probably is a stupid one, but if Ursula Le Guin had it too, it's maybe stupid adjacent, but hers is probably much more informed.
But I don't know. I mean, I think that one of the things if in this book I'm trying some way to allow for uncertainty, for some room for uncertainty in the novel, you know, that seems to me a state of uncertainty is uncomfortable for us culturally, humanly, right? Humanly, maybe just generally, it's, you know, we want things explained, but I think our culture is particularly bad at it, and I think we're super judgy. I just think we want to have an, you know, I have a friend who a few years ago, she said, I've suddenly realized I'm not called upon to have an opinion about everything. I don't have to, right? And it's, you know, but I think culturally we sort of think we are, and we do, and so, we like to feel better than others. So there's a lot of, you know, if we're not feeling better, we're feeling worse. Right? There's a lot of kind of jockeying for, am I, you know, like, we don't need to go there, but the whole likability question, right, of characters in fiction, do we need to like, why do we need to say, I think she's not a good person? Just not a good enough person. Well, so, you know, everybody, if you start with the idea, everybody's kind of doing their best, you know, I don't know. I don't know if that answers the question, but I feel like the guilt, I mean, guilt and shame, all of those things, they're tied in also to passing judgment. Mm.
And yet, one of the, you know, dominant qualities of Americanness, especially if viewed from outside of America, is of innocence. Miley has written three novels for young readers, the Apothecary series, and it's the kids basically move to London, and an apothecarist disappears, and they go looking for him, and that takes a series on. But at one point, in the most recent one, a character is describing someone, and it says, his face broke into a wide smile, a smile that made her think that Americans were different. It didn't matter how much war this man had seen, or how long he'd been alone on a deserted island. His smile came from a place of innocence. And I wonder, you know, in some ways that's appealing, but if you combine innocence with judginess, that's a very
horrible
combination. But I wonder if you can talk a little bit about your experience in the world dealing with that projection of Americanness as innocence, and what it means when you come back home aware of that, and how do you inform yourself around it? I mean, either as a person or as a fiction writer.
I think I always had a sense when I was outside of this country that people in other places grew up faster. And that was one of the things that I think I was thinking about. The Apothecary books are set in the 50s in the Cold War, and I had read this whole book that was all contemporary accounts of England after World War II, when everything had been bombed and there were no resources and you couldn't get food and you couldn't get chocolate and you couldn't get heat, and you know, and then Americans would show up, and they had just not been battered by the war in the way that Europe had, and the English were like seriously rolling their eyes about Americans all the time. So that's kind of the world in which those books are set. But I do think it's like a profound thing about this country, and I feel like I finished this book last year. In September, we were talking about the title, Do Not Become Alarmed, and some people thought it was too negative. And this is September 2016. And I really had to fight for it, and we had to go through this whole thing where we came up with every other possible title because people were worried that it would be too off-putting because it was too negative, and by November, no one was saying that anymore. And I think that the past year, I mean, I think that many people's innocence about this country is starting to fall away, and that as every week I think we understand more and more the structural racism and misogyny that this country is founded on. So I do think that it's really interesting the way, and I did my very first talk about this book on Inauguration Day in Atlanta at the American Librarians Association. I went and marched and then came back into the event, and it's been really interesting being talking about a book that is about people who are smart, thoughtful people who think they've worried about everything possible that bad that could happen so none of it can go wrong, who get blindsided by the thing they didn't expect. I read that pirate book in 2011, and it was just interesting to me how much it had started to feel like a more contemporary book than I had originally intended it to, and how that has changed throughout the last year of talking about it. It's just been interesting seeing how that happened.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, who's here, you know, wrote that stolen labor is the down payment for American liberty. And that's just one element in which our innocence as a country never actually existed to some degree. If you look at genocidal clearing of landscape and so on and so forth, but since you've opened the contemporary affairs box, I'm not going to put it away. Because right now we're living through an extraordinary period of calling account sexual predators in the public, in industries, and there's also a kind of constant drumbeat in the news of simultaneous discussions that are, they're pretty caveman-like, in which, you know, in Alabama, a state comptroller can suggest that a girl of 14 had sexual consent with a 32-year-old, you know, district attorney. And I wonder, Claire, writing in this period about a girl of that age, and you have your own children, you know, how do you keep from just turning your book into a Molotov cocktail?
You know, I think part, to come back to what Miley was saying about sort of the past year being an education, right, for all of us. I think if you think of the novel as a mirror traveling down a road, I think I cite it a lot. There's a letter that Chekhov wrote to either his friend or his brother, in which he said, "It's not my job to tell you that horse thieves are bad people. It's my job to tell you what this horse thief is like." And I think that that for me is a sort of fundamental to the way I understand fiction, right? I don't see it as so in that sense I feel as though to tell the story just as it's understood is its own Molotov cocktail in a way. There's that wonderful old expression, hoist on his own petard, right? That if you just tell it as it is, you know, tell life like it is, then all of these things actually will enter into it. And I think one of the things that, you know, that is so extraordinary about this outpouring of stories about sexual assault and sexual abuse and sexual harassment and it reminds me very strongly of all of the videos in the past years of young black men being assaulted by the police. And I actually had this conversation with somebody where I said, so you mean all these years this has been going on and we didn't know? And my friend said, yes, of course, all these years this has been going on, and there weren't cameras, so we didn't know, right? Well, not nobody knew. There were people who knew, but we weren't listening, right? As the sort of white mainstream was not listening to the truth of those stories. And now that, you know, so I've sort of headed off on a tangent.
No, that's a great point. I mean, I was on stage earlier this summer with Margaret Atwood, who said, by the way, America is not going to collapse. She's killed it off once, but she said it's too diverse. And she made this point that she said fiction is about individuals. It's not about monoliths. And as you were speaking about, you know, the fact that for many white Americans, the outpouring of videotaped or smartphone-taped brutalizations of African Americans was a shock, but it wasn't to African Americans. That's been a reality. And for many straight white male listeners or readers, what's been coming out of Louis C.K. and Bill Cosby and God, someone probably in the course of this hour has been probably outed as a terrible sexual predator, is a surprise, but it's not to women.
Well, yes and no, though. When Louis C.K. was like, oh, I just thought that if I asked women first if I could take my member out, that then it was fine. I'm like, raised by wolves? What?
Yeah.
Surprised by that.
I'm sure it was surprising for the people watching too. but to go to you, Miley, what Claire just described could be called positions of innocence. I didn't know. I didn't know women were dealing with this, or I didn't know. I didn't know. You know, black men were pulled over at the rate that they are, and often shot without, you know, even having a weapon. The characters that you've written of in this book are innocent to a lot of the things that come and blindside them, and yet they're deeply sympathetic. And I wonder, you know, you're the craftsperson. How did you pull that off? How did you not make us hate them? I'm not saying they're likable, but you didn't use them as an abuse totem.
Well, that would be a horrible novel. I feel...
I've read those novels, though.
Really? I stopped reading those novels. I was just thinking about what you were talking about. There's innocence in terms of freedom from guilt, and then there's innocence in terms of not knowing, and I feel like we're using the term sort of interchangeably, and we mean it in different ways. But I like close third person. I think that the empathy trick of putting that books, novels do of putting you in someone else's thoughts is the really important thing that fiction does, and that it makes us imagine other minds. It makes us imagine other experiences. I find close third person good. I think it's also because I started as a story writer and I like different perspectives. So I like having one narrator who is not a character who shifts their allegiances throughout the book so that you are inside of the heads of different people. And I did that with my first book, with Liars and Saints, and I was kind of struggling with how to go from writing short stories to writing a novel, and I watched one of those nature documentaries. I think it was Blue Planet, which have such amazing photography, but they also have really great storytelling. And they have a baby seal under the ice, and they have a camera under the ice, and there's a polar bear paw coming down through the hole in the ice, and the baby seal is cringing like this, and you so want the baby seal to live, and you don't want the polar bear to get it. And then they shift perspective, and they're up on the surface of the ice, and it's vast and white, and the mother polar bear has just come out of hibernation, and she has her tiny cub with her, and if she doesn't get a baby seal to eat, she will not make milk, and the cub will die, and you want her to get a baby seal. And they do that up and down the food chain. They do, like, they make you root for the herring ball that the seals eat. You're like, swim faster! Get away from that seal! And I realized that's what I was trying to do. I wanted, not that the characters are trying to eat each other, but I wanted you to be on the side of the character whose chapter you're in, even if they were in conflict with the character in a chapter before, so that you're doing that kind of empathetic exercise as you're moving through the book, and can kind of see where everyone is coming from, even if where they're coming, you know, even if they're not always right.
Mm. It's an amazing performance. There's six or seven close thirds. How many are you using? Eight?
I think there are 20.
20?
Yeah. I think so.
Basically, it's a prismatic performance of innocence and guilt, because you're watching people. You're flipping so often. We've been going for about an hour, and I think that they're going to give up this room, but I thought you might have some questions of Miley Malloy and Claire Massoud, and now might be a good time to ask them. Yes, hand went up right back there.
So my question is it possible to think of innocence separate from and without being in juxtaposition to some cultural or any other kind of expectation? So can you think of innocence in its own right? And isn't life in a way just a journey of losing your innocence? And for instance, when you talk about the conceit that is now being laid bare, and you know, the hypocrisies around the kinds of things we have told ourselves about America, for instance, isn't that just, you know, in a way, isn't that the whole, you know, life becomes one of just constantly losing our innocence around some of those beliefs?
Yeah, probably.
I think the heart of the question is it possible that the fallen innocence of the United States, if you assume that to be true, is just part of the ongoing process of losing one's innocence over the course of life? Is that a good summary?
You know, what this country is, right? Whatever that might be in terms of all the different things we we have held on to, and then we find one day that, hey, that's not true. Mm-hmm.
But I think there are people who have known that always, right? And I mean, coming back to the whole question of the stories that we tell ourselves, I think that there are some very powerful myths of our nation that people go, you know, as a culture, we go out of our way to reinforce. And maybe they have become unsustainable, or but I think the idea that all Americans have believed in those myths. I mean, just for example, the brutality against young African American men, as John was saying, African Americans have been aware of that. That's what Ta-Nehisi Coates was writing about in his last book. You know, is that there's a myth of America that was never has never pertained. It's just if you're African American, you just can't swallow it. You couldn't grow up believing in that myth because it was so manifestly untrue and not a myth designed, you know, not a myth set up for you. So I think, you know, the complexity of America is made up of individuals. There are these different ways of losing innocence. The individual, you know, individuals losing different sorts of innocence, which may be a lifelong passage. Geez, what can still go? Isn't it all gone? And then there's a sort of broader cultural sense, and they overlap, but they are distinct, I think.
There's a question back there in the white sweater.
I have a question for Miley. I was wondering how much, if any, input, but I'm sure you had input, you had in the movie Certain Women, the movie that's based on your stories.
So there's a film by Kelly Reichardt that's based on three of my short stories. One from Both Ways is the Only Way I Wanted, and two from Half in Love, and it's beautiful. And the stories are very much kind of intact in it. And I was talking to her she wrote the screenplay, she gets her own funding. She is a true independent filmmaker. She's really astonishing. And she had her own vision from the start. And we talked about the script in early stages. And we actually swapped out one of the stories for a different one. After we'd sort of talked about how to integrate the three stories. And then she just went and did her thing. She actually changed one of the stories really significantly. She made a male character female, and I didn't know that was gonna happen until I was watching the movie in a screening room, which was super disorienting and amazing. I think it's one of the best things in the film, and the character played by Lily Gladstone is so moving and so good. And that change actually made things that were kind of interior in the story, external. I just think it's a beautiful film, and I had so little to do with it. And I wrote those stories in my 20s. You know, I just kind of watch it, and it's like it's its own thing. But it's a beautiful film. If you get a chance to see it, I recommend it.
I'm afraid we've run out of time, but Miley and Claire Massoud will be signing books outside. The Burning Girl,
Thank you.
That was Claire Massoud and Miley Malloy from 2017's Portland Book Festival, presented by Bank of America. The 2018 lineup has just been announced, and the festival will take place on November 10th in downtown Portland. For more information about the author lineup, schedule, and tickets, visit literary-arts.org. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. The show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.